What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week on the show, my conversation with writer-director Kelly Reichert. When I asked Reichert what she'd like to see next for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, here's what she said.
Someone that is upset over a tort claim and someone that's trying to purchase some sandstones. You know, the hassles and the minuscule politics of day-to-day life.
Yeah, I don't think Reichert is right for the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
You're telling me Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Hemsworth couldn't make that compelling?
Well, that might work. Okay, you're convincing me.
No, I did not really ask the director of Wendy and Lucy and Meek's Cut Off about Marvel, but tort claims, sandstone, and the minuscule politics of everyday life is very much the subject of Kelly Reichert's latest film, Certain Women, which stars Reichert regular Michelle Williams, along with Laura Dern and Kristen Stewart.
Adam's interview with Reichert, our thoughts on Certain Women, and more.
Hulk smash sandstone!
Ahead on Film Spotting. You know what Avengers Infinity Wars is actually all about?
Tell me.
Tort claims.
Tort claims?
They're
it's coming.
Struggling all over tort claims.
Uh-huh. Maybe we'll never see the Kelly Reichert Marvel movie, and that's just fine if she keeps turning out the kind of films she has been over her career. We are going to get to some thoughts on Certain Women in a bit, but first, my conversation with the director of Meek's Cut Off and Wendy and Lucy, in which she discusses the challenges of working with limited budgets, about letting Michelle Williams do her thing, and what she told her Certain Women camera operators not to shoot. But Josh, since Reichert is a favorite of ours here on the show, I thought it wouldn't be out of place to start our conversation by buttering her up a little. Kelly, I'm not sure how embarrassed you are by flattery, but you are a favorite director of ours here on Film Spotting. On our 500th episode in 2014, we shared our top five films of the Film Spotting era. That was 2005 to 2014. My co-host put Meek's Cut Off on his list, and it was an honorable mention for me. And then just a few months ago, we did the top five directors we'd bankroll. Basically, if we had unlimited funds, we'd provide whatever budget the filmmaker needed, and you were on my list. Sadly, I can't follow through on that desire.
You don't have unlimited funds.
I do not. But you know, here's to hoping.
Appreciate the thought.
Yeah, I am curious though, what challenges you have in getting your movies financed first, and second, if you had unlimited funds at your disposal, would a Kelly Reichert film really look and feel much different?
Who can say? I think the experience would be less brutal, mm-hmm. probably. It's really these films that have been put together by two producers, Neil Kopp and Anish Subjani of Film Science, and it really is producing a lot of creativity on their end of how you can go to such remote places on such small budgets and pull this all off. And so, you know, having a good producing team is kind of key to this sort of thing, not to mention having everybody who's willing to sort of take the ride. But yeah, it's hard to say. There'd be more time.
Yeah.
You know, I always sort of have the feeling that we're just getting started and we have to rush on. And I guess the main thing that I long for is just to have more time.
Right.
But I've heard directors with larger budgets. I've had this conversation with Gus Van Sant, and he says that when you have more funds, just your problems are just different, but that
mm-hmm.
you always feel stretched. And I've seen that with Todd Haynes, watching him make films. It's just sort of, but, you know, small films, they don't generate a lot of money. So, you know, it's all understandable.
Yeah. I feel like one of the things I love about your films is that you tell really intimate stories, but often on a very grand canvas. So as you said, the experience of making them might be better if you had more money or more comfortable and you might have more time. But would you try to change the canvas at all? I'm guessing you probably wouldn't, or change the material at all. You are getting to tell the stories you want to tell.
No, I mean, I think you're drawn to what you're drawn to. And I'm interested in, I have a film out right now, and if I had to describe the plot of it, it's someone that is upset over a tort claim and someone that's trying to purchase some sandstones. So, mm-hmm. you know, these aren't blockbuster themes. They're more, you know, the hassles and the minuscule politics of day-to-day life. And that's, I don't know, that's interesting to me. I like the small strokes. And I want to work on things that I'm going to be interested in for the whole ride.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a long ride when you make a film and you have to wake up interested in it. And that's what's great about it.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that the overall, I mean, I want to expand my, you know, I want to do different things. I want to challenge myself.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the details and the small strokes, and something I keyed into very early with certain women is the attention you pay to physicality and to gestures and what they might reveal about the character's psyches. When we meet Michelle Williams' character, for example, she's the one who is seeking the standstone. She's wearing a full-on runner's outfit, but isn't running, as I recall. Doesn't really seem like she's been running at all. And when she puts her cigarette out, we watch her not just drop it on the ground, but drop it and bury it as if she's trying to stamp it out of existence. And I feel like we know so much about her in a matter of a minute. This is her escape from who or what we don't know yet. And that cigarette is her release, a habit she's hiding from who or what we don't quite know yet. And it's totally possible I'm reading too much into that action, but how do you approach capturing that bit of behavior? Is it something you discuss and choreograph with your actress, or is it something that organically comes out of Williams' performance?
Well, we had been talking about what the, just starting the character off with some secret that she has from her family, and it's almost the thing you are most judged on today is, you know, cigarette smoking would almost be worse than if, you know, we saw her shooting up in the woods. Yeah, she's a smoker, and I just sort of give her the space I want her to work in, and then, you know, Michelle does her thing. And, yeah, we tried a few times, and but mostly it's just giving Michelle the space to do what Michelle wants to do.
Following up on that, her character here, we can intuit, is the outsider of all the main characters in the three stories. Without knowing the whole backstory, we recognize that she seems to be coming to this Montana location trying to find some happiness or make her own happiness. She seems to be craving authenticity, even if it means being a little duplicitous in her own personal interactions. And it occurred to me that she's played a similar character for you before, the traveler seeking a new home out west, lost in Meek's Cutoff, and, of course, as Wendy in Wendy and Lucy, a drifter looking to start a new life in Alaska. What is it about Michelle Williams that captures this restless, I guess, alien spirit?
I mean, when working on a story, I'm not thinking of how it works with films we've made previously at all. So, you know, I've never even really thought of it in those terms. In certain women, Michelle, I think she doesn't know how to fix what's happening, the Gina character, what's happening in her family on an emotional level. So she sets out to create like a perfect house, which is something she can sort of get her arms around. Yeah, and so she has to navigate taking something from someone, and she really wants that person to be happy about giving it to her, even though he's clearly not. And so I think there's a little of the Old West in that, of coming and conquering and trying to convince yourself that there's something good about it.
You said that you just try to give Michelle her space. Is that how you work with all actors for the most part, or they're all unique creatures, obviously? Do you treat them in that unique way?
Yeah, every situation is really different, and we don't have a lot of rehearsal time, so you kind of live with an idea of what you think a scene is going to be like in your head for so long. And then working with all the fine actors I've been able to work with, you know, you don't really know what that scene's going to be like until they're all responding and reacting to each other, and that whatever it is that happens, the dynamic between people that's not on the page, that's just whatever is on that day according to that weather and that setting and everyone's mood of that day, you know, the film takes on a life of its own. And so I think the idea is to sort of go with a plan and then just stay really open to the possibility of what going to emerge, and know that what's going to emerge isn't going to be exactly what you planned in your head. And that's what's exciting about it. And you are just trying to sort of set a space for a scene to play out. And it's a collaboration, and we make small adjustments, or, you know, I might just block things out with the actors, or we might start with just seeing what the actors do in a space and working from there. It really depends on the location and what the day has, but there's always something that comes of it that you're not anticipating.
Mm-hmm.
In the scene with Jared Harris and Laura Dern in the car, you know, I had fully, the way I imagined it in my mind was that Jared would be more aggressive and angry, and Laura would be, I can't even exactly remember how I pictured it because I'm so used to it the way it is, but I do remember that they both took on the role in completely opposite ways than I had anticipated,
mm-hmm.
the way they responded to each other. And it did take me aback, and it was something I had to settle into. But when that sort of dynamic happens, you kind of, I don't know, my tendency sometimes is to, I think, go with it, because as opposed to force someone into responding in a way they're mm-hmm. not.
Yeah.
And it just works in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, and it, whatever, it's not always the case. It's really scene to scene and moment to moment.
Wish my wife would roll over on the highway.
Oh my God, I swear I will leave you right here.
The only thing left to do is get a machine gun and kill everyone.
No. No. You're gonna have to get out.
All right.
Out. No, you can't say those things to me.
Not another word.
You can't talk like that.
Never mind. I'll be quiet.
It can also be, of course, difficult to anticipate how audiences are going to respond to your work or any work, but in just a quick scan of reactions to certain women by critics I follow, the consensus seemed to be, and everyone I saw is pretty enamored with the film, I will say, but the consensus seemed to be that their favorite of the three stories is actually the third one, the one featuring Kristen Stewart as a law student, or a former law student, now a lawyer, who ends up taking a teaching job in a town too far away, and Lily Gladstone as a rancher, and their friendship / relationship. Part of that might just be that Stewart has lately deservedly become a bit of a critical darling, but I have a few other theories as well. I'm just curious, has that preference for that arc, that act, been one that you've picked up on as well? And do you have any sense of what it is in the material or how it is rendered that people are connecting with it so strongly?
Well, I think in Miley Malloy's short story that you're starting from a point where it's there in her story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you kind of, the way you move into the film, I mean, Laura Dern's character is in a much more reactionary mode. So she has to just keep reacting to her client's position. And then in the middle story, Michelle Williams is not playing the most, I think she's incredibly relatable, but she's not the most easy to love character in the world.
For sure, yeah.
And, you know, she's faulty.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that Michelle just went for it so much, and she's so not interested in playing a perfectly beloved character. She likes playing someone an audience can dislike. And so, and the third story is just one that, where the Lily Gladstone character is just really easy to have a lot of empathy for her. And it's a more subjective approach, so the viewer's more in her shoes. So I think there's different things at work there.
Why were you afraid of selling shoes?
Have you ever sold shoes?
I mean, why were you afraid you couldn't get anything else?
I don't know, because my mom works in a school cafeteria, my sister in a hospital laundry, so selling shoes is the nicest job a girl from my family is supposed to get. It all worked out. See, I'm a lawyer with a wonderful job, driving all the way to Belfry every 15 minutes until I lose my mind.
In saying that it's in Miley's story, I think the performances in the third story, Lily and Kristen are really amazing. So
they are. So
it's a combination of those things.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I have my favorite movie scores and soundtracks just like anyone else, but I do tend to find myself more often drawn to films that don't rely much or at all on music. I think I just prefer to watch the actors and the screenplay do their work without any music kind of telling me how to feel. I didn't notice any music in Certain Women until the end credits, and without being able to go back and check all of your films, that didn't strike me anyway as an atypical choice. What's your philosophy when it comes to scoring or not scoring your movies? And is it, in fact, a philosophy, or is it just determined by the material?
There is a tiny bit of score in one moment in the third story, and that was a piece by Jeff Grace, and he did the music for Night Moves and Meek's Cutoff. But we kind of, well, in this case, I would say it is score. I mean, in the previous films, we try to approach it like it's not going to be music per se, but sounds, you know, like Meek's Cutoff, he used sort of distorted flutes, but we only used instruments from that would have been around at that period, and they're all pretty distorted. But a lot of the times in place, I'm using, for example, in Certain Women, the Livingston when we're shooting has a big depot around it, and you're almost never not hearing trains when you're there. And there's traffic, and there's just the kind of day-to-day sounds of a city, or in the case of Lily Gladstone, who's the rancher who's a bit out of range, there's the static on her radio. So it's just more about trying to find the sounds that are there. It's also a super, super windy town.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wind just has really different sounds according to what location we were on, and our sound team was so great at capturing those. So I had a bunch of wind sounds to work with. But just trying to use as score, basically, sounds that are more traffic as score or trains or whatever's in the environment where we're shooting.
Yeah, it's really effective. And it obviously provides a soundscape and a sound design that does render music, I think, not really necessary. I really do appreciate that. A couple more questions for you here, Kelly. I know you did say earlier that you're not really thinking about your characters or your movies within the scope of your other films when you're making a movie. But in me preparing for this and thinking about Certain Women within the context of your other films, I was struck by how much your characters and by extension, and the best word I could come up with, the audience are demythified. Without cataloging them all, these locations, the Pacific Northwest, that the locations are set in can be seen as these Edenic kind of settings, and you often have characters embarking on journeys in search of a better life. Even the two friends in Old Joy, the two men, perhaps romanticize how redemptive this weekend reunion could be. Your characters have strong ideals. Sometimes they're trying to maintain or impose on others, like in Night Moves. And then these myths are usually shattered. Here in Certain Women, you're in Montana. The landscape could be so beautiful and magnificent, but you're shooting largely in winter. It's cold. It's foreboding. It's filled with grays and browns and beiges or taupes like Laura Dern's sweater in that opening scene, which isn't to say there isn't still great cinematography. There are a lot of wonderful shots, but there's little that's grandiose or romantic about the landscapes or the lives of most of the people we meet. And I was just wondering where that urge to tell those kind of stories that demythify comes from.
Yeah, well, when we're making the films, it's part of what's fun and nice about it is going to a new place and living in the space for a while and getting a routine down where you're figuring out where your grocery store would be or your post office or your recycling, all the chores of a day, and trying to, or in the case of Night Moves, you know, being on the farm or, you know, just depending where it's set. And so, yeah, the environment it's just trying to work in the space as if you know, along with the people that live there and see it every day and are not tourists passing through and in awe with it, but are aware of how things become every day that you see every day that, you know, are no longer spectacular because you're seeing it every day, but maybe in a glimpse you look up and you are reminded of the beauty of where you are, mm-hmm. according to, you know, that time of day when the light's so beautiful or something. But sorry, things got so loud.
That's all right. But, it's that soundscape again, the environment creeping in.
Wow. I'm in a war zone. But yeah, so that's the idea is, you know, we have like a rule on set, you know, no beauty shots. And it's just a way, when I'm working with Chris Blauvelt, my cinematographer, where we, even the, when I leave at the end of, when the day is finally over, it's funny, the camera assistants, you know, especially out in Montana, the first and second camera guys will be, they, you know, have held off all day on the beauty shots, and I'll like go by and see them setting up the camera, you know, shooting a sunset or grabbing some, like you can hardly stand it. And so that's always a funny little thing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Thank you very much, Kelly Reichert, for your time. Best of luck with the film Certain Women is out in theaters now.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for the support. I appreciate it.
I don't mean to keep you from getting to work or anything. I just knew if I didn't start driving, I wasn't going to see you again. Didn't want that.
It would be so lovely to think that if I were a man, people would listen and say, okay. It would be so restful.
My thanks again to Kelly Reichert. It really was a thrill to get to finally talk to her here on the show. And Josh, the question I didn't get to, I had a few, but one I definitely was going to try to sneak in there at the end, and we just ran out of time, was to ask her about her work as an editor. You'll recall when we did our top five directors we'd bankroll, though actually you were off for that show. Tasha Robinson was sitting across from me, but I mentioned that one of the reasons why I would want to fund her career and wherever it may take her and her films is because we are truly getting her voice and her vision. Certain Women is her sixth film as a director, and she wrote or co-wrote five of them, and she edited five of them. Her debut film was the only exception. So with some directors, they really love that collaboration with an editor and being able to turn the material over to fresh eyes. And I was curious why she preferred to really own all of that herself. But then again, I think that's maybe one of the strengths of her work, is that her fingerprints are clearly all over every film that she makes. Now, you heard us in there talk about the third act with Kristen Stewart and Lily Gladstone and how that seems to be a favorite for a lot of people. Along with that, I've noticed a few people comment on the second act, the one with Michelle Williams, being a little bit of an outlier, maybe being not as effective or just not fitting as well overall with the others. I'm curious if you agree with either of those sentiments and what your thoughts are overall on the film.
I found them all equally compelling. I'd say I can see that observation about the middle section, and maybe we wouldn't feel that way if we learned a bit more about Michelle Williams' occupation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hint that she is the boss of her husband, played by James LaGrosse. And so we understand that, but we don't quite know what the business is or how that impacts her everyday life in the way that we do with the Laura Dern, and certainly not only with the Kristen Stewart, but also the Lily Gladstone characters.
Yeah, where she's more elusive in every way.
Yeah, I think that's fair too. But this, you know, this movie really is at heart, or at least it puts us right in the middle of these women's lives, what it means to be a working woman in this time and place, the specific time and place. And so when that middle section is a bit more removed from that, I could see the separation. I mean, narratively, it's actually the third act with Stewart and Gladstone that is less connected to the other two, because James LaGrosse's character has a direct tie to also the Laura Dern section.
Right.
So those two felt like they took place a little bit more in the same space than the third. But really, you know, this structure didn't throw me – I didn't feel any sort of off-balance sensibility to the film.
Yeah.
I think she nicely, and maybe this does speak to her work as an editor, nicely brings these together in a way that does make us feel we're seeing different angles on this Montana community, yet also is not so interwoven that it feels hackneyed or forced.
Yeah. And in terms of that last bit she was discussing in the interview, the approach to the cinematography, it's one thing to feel fairly confident in how you're reading a film, something that seems fairly obvious to you, and then it's another thing to have the director validate that. And she really did with that line where she says that, yeah, she had to constantly reinforce to her team that there were going to be no beauty shots here. And that, as I did suggest during the conversation, that doesn't mean there aren't some wonderful individual shots and some great uses of the camera, but even the very opening of this film, that Montana landscape and the mountains and the train going through it. This is stuff that could be mythical and in another filmmaker's hands would be depicted that way. And it doesn't come off that way at all. It feels much more barren and isolated.
It's taking place, it seems, before sunrise.
Yeah.
So you don't have that bit of glory coming in yet. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, you know, I'm probably less interested, or I should put it this way. Often I'll discount what the director intended. I'm more willing to do that than you and just consider what my experience of the film was. But I'm exactly with you when I heard the interview that you did with Reichert and compared it to my reaction or what I took away from it. And I didn't listen to it till after I had written my review. And one of the things I said right at the start here does almost mimic her comments. I wrote, the movie never insists on the natural wonders that surround it. There are no ostentatious landscape shots, but rather sits with them silently as we would if we lived among such sights every day. Mm-hmm. And I think her comment about not wanting to be tourists, that's what I was picking up there. I very much felt as if I had lived in this place.
Mm-hmm.
And that is different than a movie that takes you to a place surrounded by gorgeous landscapes and shoves those at you. And I'm one who I'm a sucker for landscape photography in movies.
Of course.
I probably give it too much credit in some instances rather than appreciate when it's used in a more subdued way. But what I liked about that approach here by Reichert and the cinematographer is that it mirrors exactly the tenor of these women's lives, in that they are also surrounded by beautiful potential, but don't always get a chance to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie is going to be disregarded by some and called slow and said that not much happens. And that's true. Even the opening one, which involves a hostage situation, has to be the most low-key hostage situation I've ever seen. I mean, there are tense moments, but compared to most, yet this movie builds and builds and builds until, and I don't even want to give it away, even though it's probably the scene in the movie, in that final section with Gladstone and Stewart, there's a moment between them. They share something and it opens everything up till you realize there has been beauty all around them. And for this one second, actually, these two are going to experience. And actually, Reichert gives in a little bit. And you'll notice as these two are together, she allows the streetlight to shine from behind them and create this just a little bit of a halo effect. It's nothing overpowering, but compared to most of the movie, it jumps out at you. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the movie, you're right, is still very painterly in some ways. I thought of the work of Andrew Wyeth. There's a shot of Laura Dern in a hotel room, and we see her in a circular mirror that's in the far right corner of the frame, and the rest of the frame is just the dim brown wall of the room.
Very careful how she's sectioned off from James LaGrosse in that scene.
Yep, absolutely. And at the same time, you know, none of these are strikingly beautiful colors or patterns or textures, but it's so carefully composed that it does speak to a certain sort of it's a glum beauty is how I would describe it.
Yeah, I think it's instinctive on the audience's part to want to see what's connecting these stories. And I think to Reichert's credit, there's not one thing all of these stories are about. It's just not that simple. But for me, what really hit home, and this goes back to what you don't want to give away in a moment, and I'm thinking actually of the scene that follows it with Gladstone and Kristen Stewart. Thinking about that, there is a moment in another section of this film where a character says to another, I didn't know what to say. They couldn't believe that they didn't write to them or write back to them. And the character says, I didn't know what to say. And there are a lot of moments in this film where characters don't know what to say. And so they don't. They linger in the awkwardness, in that pause, and we stay with them through that silence. And maybe that's the only thing that's unrealistic about Kelly Reichert's very realistic films, and I think that's a good thing, is that the one thing most of us do all the time is try to fill all of those awkward silences with something, no matter how inarticulate we might be or how dishonest or honest we're being. We try to fill those moments, and her characters do exist in those moments, and I think those are the most gratifying moments of her films. Ultimately, she is, though, such a low stakes filmmaker in terms of what you would think of as conventional plotting, but that doesn't mean in each scenario for these characters, these encounters and these experiences aren't life and death.
Yes,
they are.
And you feel that
the high stakes that I'm after in every film. You just have to, I think, be willing to follow Reichert's rhythm and the tone and the mood that she so capably sets. I do think that the Stewart, I hate to go along with conventional wisdom, I think the Stewart and Gladstone one probably is the most compelling of the three. And Kristen Stewart's very good, but Gladstone is a real revelation.
Yes.
The first time I've seen her on screen, amazing presence. Her character is herself a mystery. She's the least open book of any of the other characters, I think, in the movie, probably. And she's probably the most universal in terms of what we bring to it. That sense of longing that she so subtly conveys. She breaks your heart without ever doing anything to try to break your heart, which
right.
is the most you could ever ask of an actress. And the connection that she feels to Kristen Stewart's character that isn't reciprocated, we can all relate to that.
And the amazing thing about her performance, too, is so often she's holding the entire film all alone.
Mm-hmm.
This is true of all of the performances. Reichert is very comfortable filming each of these women on their own, just sitting in their individual specific sort of loneliness
mm-hmm.
and letting us experience it as they are experiencing it. And Gladstone does this through her work as this ranch hand that, on a ranch where apparently no one else is working.
Right.
She seems to be maybe the winter caretaker or something like that. There's just enough work for one person, and she has this job taking the horses in and out, dispensing the hay and so forth. And so we get, again, rhythm, the rhythm of her work routine and her day. And a lot of the times, she's not speaking to anyone then. Even when she does meet Stewart, their conversations are, again, quiet. There are silences. It's more her watching Stewart and us understanding what she's thinking through her
mm-hmm.
expressions more than anything she says. And that moment at the end between them, heartbreaking is the right word. You see it coming, right?
Yeah.
You know where it's going. And it's just like seeing a car accident coming
mm-hmm.
and those seconds get stretched out before you know there's going to be an impact. There's nothing you can do. And there's nothing that she can't stop herself from doing what she does.
Mm-hmm.
She has to. And you just wonder, did she know too where it's going to lead? But she felt like she has to do this anyway.
Maybe final thought here. It's funny that you say that the Gladstone and Stewart section is the one that feels the least connected in terms of anyway, the most direct connections that do exist between these three sections. For me, it was the Michelle Williams one that stood out, partly because she's the only outsider, as came up in my conversation with Reichert. It's suggested that she's maybe come to this area and is looking for some kind of happiness as opposed to the others who inhabit the
mm-hmm.
place that they are. For me, there's a real connection between Gladstone and her attraction, let's say, to Stewart's character and the opening sequence with Laura Dern, and I can't believe I'm blanking on the actor's name, Jared Harris.
Jared Harris, yeah.
Jared Harris, so good here.
Right, yeah.
Similar to Gladstone in someone who's so in need of a human connection and a sounding board and someone to just connect with him.
Except he's very open
yeah,
in his
of course,
needs.
Yeah, of
right?
course, but
he's like an open wound.
But the neediness, I guess, is what
yes, his neediness is right
what
up
I front. Latched onto, and Williams doesn't convey any of that kind of vulnerability, or she doesn't convey the neediness. I'll say that. I think the vulnerability does come through in her performance a little bit, but it is interesting to me that if you look really carefully, that second section with Michelle Williams ends with an almost identical shot to the first section with Laura Dern, where she is, without spoiling anything at all, because there's very little to spoil in this film, she's looking at Jared Harris, a character she's, let's say, betrayed in a sense, and she looks at him a little wistfully, or however we want to read into it, because Reichert, of course, doesn't underline it. And that second section ends as well with the woman, in this case Williams, looking at a man that she has maybe betrayed in a sense. It's just very interesting how those two line
mm-hmm.
up, but I didn't see a matching one to that necessarily, not that I needed one in the third section.
I will say for that middle section that the family dynamics there are so precise and knowing
yes.
and nuanced between husband and wife and between teen daughter. Again, more in what is not said
yeah.
than what is said. Although one of my favorite scenes in this movie is the shot of LaGrosse backing up the family truck
yeah.
down a long driveway. Michelle Williams is not in the car. She went to open the gate. The teen daughter is sullenly slumped in the middle seat, and they're having a conversation about just trying to negotiate, and maybe it's because I'm at that stage of life, the difficult
yeah.
relationship between a mother, teen daughter, and father,
mm-hmm.
and how you all are trying to be on the same page,
yeah.
and the complications that ensue. And in one shot, Reichert gets it so right as that truck. There's something about the truck backing up and him looking over his shoulder.
Right, and the camera just being stationary.
Yeah, the camera's stationary as the truck is moving.
We feel the daughter's presence, but we're looking at him the whole time. We recognize Williams' absence from the scene as they're talking about her.
Yes, there's an empty seat there. Mm-hmm. I haven't quite sussed out why that was such a powerful moment for me, but it was. And again, it's one of these – it's not a powerhouse dramatic moment at all, but it hits home in the way, the unexpected way that so many – of Reichert scenes do.
Certain Women opens in limited release this weekend here in Chicago and elsewhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our thoughts, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
We are smack dab in the middle of the Chicago International Film Festival. Adam and I, we were able to attend a screening tonight. We've been able to take a preview look at a couple of the other festival offerings. So we're going to share our thoughts on those movies when we come back. Stay with us.
Stranger in the bar tells me to smile.
I think this bum knows where he is.
They call this place Valley of Violence.
Why don't you back up before you find out why? You talk too much.
Josh, you remember I dubbed this year the Year of the Hawk, right? Well, yeah, it continues.
I remember the ceremony.
Ethan Hawke in the trailer for In the Valley of Violence from director Ty West looks like something of a departure for West, best known for old school horror movies like The House of the Devil and The Innkeepers. This new one is set in the Old West and along with Hawke stars John Travolta and James Ransone, who was so memorable as the pimp slash boyfriend from last year's Golden Brick winner Tangerine. He appeared on the screen with Sean Baker, thanking us for awarding them the Golden Brick. Thank you, James, for that. Next week, well, we think we're going to get to some thoughts on In a Valley of Violence, which opens this weekend. I think it's out on demand as well this weekend. And we're hoping for another special surprise. We've got a good top five planned, and we may even work in somehow. Again, don't hold us to any of this because we're just waiting on some things to fall into place. But we are thinking we might actually do another one of our Halloween Sacred Cow reviews. And we're going to watch a film that for me is actually a blind spot. For you, definitely qualifies as a Sacred Cow. It's 1984's Nightmare on Elm Street.
See, I was wondering about that. You have not seen it.
I don't think I have.
I'm sure you've seen bits and pieces.
I, of course, have seen bits and pieces. And I know that I have for sure seen bits and pieces of Nightmare on Elm Street 3. Dream Warriors.
Okay. Just put that out of your mind when you go into A Nightmare on Elm Street. You're in for a bloody, terrifying time.
Who's going to watch it with
me? No, I'm demanding
who's gonna
you
hold
watch
my
this.
Hand?
You watch this alone in the basement.
No.
Come on.
There's not a chance.
Proper conditions.
Well, maybe we could tease the top five because whether our surprise happens or not, top five is a great Sam Van Halgren suggestion, another great Sam Van Halgren suggestion. And for longtime listeners of the show, they're almost certainly going to get a little bit of redundancy in my choices. I've told some of these stories over the years, but we're going to share our top five. The way I was phrasing it was earliest scares. So basically,
movie scares.
Yeah, movie scares.
Not just general scares. Not like when Adam first saw a snake.
Man, that could be so traumatic to relive.
Kind of a boring story.
We're going to relive the five most tragic events of our childhoods. No, we're just going to revisit the five most traumatic events watching scary movies.
Good.
From our youth.
So do you already have these?
Yeah.
They're right.
Yeah.
They're like seared in your memory.
I mean,
right?
I am going to put in some time, put in a little work, and search the recesses of my traumatized brain and see if there's something I'm overlooking, maybe something I've repressed
yes.
a little bit.
Well, I think we should each have a counseling session and see what comes out and then finalize our list.
I think that sounds like a separate podcast. We should just go ahead and record that. Who wouldn't listen to that? But I do have right now the five in mind.
Yeah.
I think there are five obvious answers. What about mm-hmm. you?
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. I'll be curious to
ready
see if
to
we
go.
Have any overlap.
Oh, we're
I doubt
not
we
have
will
any overlap
because we're wired completely well, differently. And also we had very different childhoods.
Yes. And my number one is seeing Footloose.
How dare you? How dare you? Okay. We have a live show to promote, Josh. We are very excited that we are going to be doing a show along with our friends from Film Spotting SVU. The SVU investigators, Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore, are going to be in Chicago. We're going to do a live show here at Shuba's Friday, November 18th. Tickets are on sale now.
And just to warn people who have come to our previous live shows, which we've trimmed them down a little
yes,
bit,
we have.
But they're usually around 2 hours. This does not mean
Why
a 5 hour.
Why are you looking
hour.
At me
this
when you say that?
This does not mean, because I want confirmation here,
uh-huh.
for my own personal endurance, this does not mean a 5 hour show. Matt and Allison are doing their show
yes.
for maybe half
about
hour,
35 minutes.
45 minutes.
Yeah.
Then we're going to come on for about an hour, right?
Right,
Adam?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like we do every week on the radio after Sam edits out 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And Sam will just have to do that live somehow.
Lean and Mean Film Spotting live show.
Now, I don't
come
know if that's actually
it.
Going to help sell tickets. I'm just saying. Not that people want to sit through a 3 hour marathon show, but they're only going to see 60 minutes. Are you underselling?
Wait, 60 minutes?
Yeah,
well,
that's
we got
it.
About an hour.
Yeah, we get an hour.
We get an hour. Matt and Allison get a half hour. We're,
you're right.
Yeah,
I meant 60 minutes of the magic that
oh.
is Adam and Josh.
Yeah, I think they'll have had enough.
Well, we hope that you will come out and you can be the judge of how much Adam and Josh is enough. Tickets are on sale. You can find all the details over at filmspotting.net in our top stories or go to chicagopodcastfestival.org. It is poll question time. And a few weeks ago, we actually shared these results as we were looking ahead to the 52nd annual Chicago International Film Festival. It's ongoing, runs through the 27th. We wanted you to pick from 7 or 8 great options of high-profile international films playing the fest, which one you were most anticipating. And Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden was the runaway winner with 42%. Asghar Farhadi's The Salesman and Paul Verhoeven's Elle with Isabelle Huppert were the runners-up.
We did hear from listener Zach, who shared this about the poll question. Full disclosure, I don't live in Chicago, and I don't have any plans to attending this particular festival because I've actually seen a couple of these titles at the local festival here in Melbourne. But I did want to butt in and proclaim my admiration of Graduation, the new Christian Mungiu flick. It probably won't score well in a poll featuring films from more provocative filmmakers like Paul Verhoeven and Park Chan-wook, and I probably enjoyed The Handmaiden, Park's best in years, more. But Graduation is a really brilliant, subdued film from a director who constantly wrangles terrific, authentic performances from his actors. If I was nearby, I wouldn't mind checking out A Quiet Passion, because after Sunset Song, I realized Terrence Davies is a director I need to devote more time to, and because Cynthia Nixon was lights out in the last film I saw her in, James White. Actually, who am I kidding? In all honesty, I would crack and go straight to see The Handmaiden again.
Wow. Okay. So a pretty strong endorsement there for The Handmaiden. And speaking of that film, if you want to know what all the fuss is about, you can see it here before it opens. Our Chicago listeners, Josh, have a chance to enter to win. There's an advanced screening on Wednesday, October 26th, and we're giving away a pair of passes. All the information and the link to enter is at filmspotting.net.
Who cares about this stupid election? We all know it doesn't matter who gets elected president of Carver. Do you really think it's going to change anything around here? Make one single person smarter, or happier, or nicer? The only person it does matter to is the one who gets elected.
Truth, Tammy Metzler. Truth. Jessica Campbell there as Metzler in Alexander Payne's Election from 1999. And since this is the last poll question we'll be asking before Election Day here in the United States, it's November 8th. The subject of the poll is election-related movies. And for the record, we strongly disagree with Tammy's premise there. We actually think it does matter who gets elected president of Carver High. And we encourage everyone to vote on Election Day.
Come on, Tammy. Whatever happened to citizenship?
While you're at it, vote in this poll question. It's easy. It's painless. Just go to filmspotting.net. The poll's right there on the right side of the page. Best election movie. man, do we have a lot of options, and we've got some pretty great options as well. Josh, take it away.
Bob Roberts from 1992, directed by Tim Robbins, with Robbins playing the candidate, singing bigot Bob Roberts. Then there's Bulworth from 1999, director Warren Beatty, also directing himself as the candidate here, the financially ruined senator with a death wish, Jay Bulworth. And then the candidate, of course, would be on this list from 1972, Michael Ritchie, the director, and Robert Redford as the lefty lawyer who is in over his head. Election, which you just heard, is another option. Tracy Flick, of course, the candidate there, played by Reese Witherspoon. And the Manchurian candidate from 1962, directed by John Frankenheimer. In this case, the candidate is a brainwashed Korean War hero, Raymond Shaw, played by Lawrence Harvey. A few more here for you. Milk, Gus Van Sant's biopic about the first openly gay elected official, Harvey Milk, played by Sean Penn. Primary Colors, I don't know, does this count as a biopic? Not really, but sort of. Mike Nichols' take on the Clinton story with John Travolta as a smart Southern smooth-talking womanizer.
And if we didn't give you enough options, we're going to give you other.
We do have other. So Wag the Dog, maybe? The War Room?
Yeah, I think The War Room would have to be in there. Wag the Dog, I'm trying to remember, is that technically a candidate movie? They're trying to cover up or distract from...
Is there an election involved?
A scandal, but I can't remember if it's just trying to distract from the president.
It's another, so...
It doesn't matter.
It have to be that specific.
Someone can write in and tell me.
I have my write-in
or
vote
I can
for this.
It.
Well, we could, but why work that hard? Will Ferrell's The Campaign. I know I wasn't a part of this poll conversation, but...
My guy Adam McKay?
No, it's not Adam McKay. I actually don't remember
maybe that's why
the
I haven't
director
seen it.
Of this one. But it is pretty funny. Zach Galifianakis is in that one as well, so
yeah.
I might be going that way with The Campaign.
Wait a second. You're going to go with The Campaign, which, again, I haven't seen over some of these options on this list, Josh, because there are some great films here. I mean... Truly, I think great films. Bob Roberts, I love The Candidate, I love Election, I love The Manchurian Candidate, I love Milk. The only two weak choices here at all are Primary Colors and Bulworth. I'm just not a fan of either one of those films, but I love the other options, and I love The War Room. So I don't know where I'm going. I'm going to have to think about it. There's just too many good candidates here, Josh. Now, here's maybe the more fun one to discuss, though certainly the more personal and the one that would certainly get us into the most trouble potentially with our audience. For discussion's sake, forget your favorite film of these options. Which real or fictional candidate would get your vote if they were all actually running for president?
Another write-in, Wiener.
You haven't even seen it.
No,
you just wanted to say it.
Of course. I wanted to see you giggle.
It worked.
I like to see it. See?
Congratulations. See, you're avoiding answering. I thought about this one a little bit.
Now, certainly,
Bob Roberts is not getting my vote. Bulworth isn't getting my vote.
I think it's interesting that a lot of them are despicable, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, you've got a guy like Bill McKay, who Redford plays in The Candidate. My politics probably most closely align with him, but my actual vote is Harvey Milk.
Yeah, I thought about that as well.
There you go.
Those are the two ways you'd probably want to go. Those are the two most positive portrayals. Is that fair to say?
Yeah,
I think it is. Poor Raymond Shaw, he's brainwashed.
Well,
so
yeah.
You can't hold it against
him. Really blame him.
Maybe I'll vote for him.
Vote now at filmspotting.net if you leave a comment, and we hope you do. Please let us know where you're listening from.
Elokuun 17. päivä tehdään suomalaista urheiluhistoriaa. Tuolle Olli Mäki kohtaa amerikkalaisen Davey Moore, hallitsevan höyhensarjan maailmanmestari. Te voitte olla varmoja, että me tullaan tekemään kaikkemme, että mestaruus jää Suomeen.
Now, all of you played along with our recent contemporary Nordic cinema marathon, so you all recognize that language as Finnish. A bit of the trailer there for the new film, The Happiest Day in the Life of Olli Mäki from Finland's Juho Kuusmanen. Olli Mäki won the Uncertain Regard Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival. It had its U.S. premiere right before we came here to the studio to tape, Josh, in Chicago at the Chicago International Film Festival. Our friends at MUBI are the distributors of the film. We were very happy to be there. We got a chance to talk very briefly with the filmmaker afterward, and it does have one more screening before the fest ends on the 27th, when people will hear this show, Monday the 24th at 3:15 in the afternoon, if you can make it out. Do you recommend that people try?
Definitely, yeah. I was surprised by this because the description are things I sort of are like, I don't know. It's based on a true story, a real life boxer, 1962, Finnish boxer who took on the American world champion at that time.
Yeah, the lightweight or
yeah,
featherweight, whatever.
Yeah, the match is set in Finland the first time ever. And, you know, already I'm a little – but the director, Kosman, in introducing it, said something very crucial that I think we both kind of sat up in our seats a little bit, is I knew this movie would have to be funny as well. And from our marathon, we knew that that was an important aspect of the majority of the films we enjoyed. And so I already saw this was going to have something distinct. But it did have humor. But for me, what surprised me even more is how romantic this was.
Yeah.
And it does set Maki's training and preparation for this against the fact that he falls in love with a woman just around the same time, played quite wonderfully, I thought, by Una Erola.
She's great.
And it's just becomes – partly this is because it's shot in black and white, I think. So it has this romantic tinge to it. Not syrupy, but their relationship is so sweet and nicely developed parallel alongside the boxing scenes that it was just very enjoyable. I guess some could say maybe – it would have been better if she had been given a bit more of the narrative. She is very much the side character to his story. I think that's the perspective of the film. So there's a reason for that. And again,
it's all about his inner struggle.
It is about his inner struggle between those two things. So I think it does make sense. And again, Erola brings so much in just her presence of loving him, indifferent to – not just indifferent to the boxing, but to the success, I guess. And there is something so sweet about that that captured me.
I agree completely. And it's a testament to her presence and how good the performance is and how well directed the film is that I was aware as I was watching it how few scenes there were of conventional movie romance. They spend a lot of their time just being together.
Enjoying each other's company.
Right.
Yes.
And they're
not
very
wooing each other,
they're
not
different
doing
people.
Cliched things.
He's all introverted. He is a man of very few words, but he seems very comfortable with her and actually seems very uncomfortable in the world when he's not with her. And the fact that they just are that comfortable with each other is what really comes through. It's funny that you mentioned the humor and what the director said. He did give a very brief talk before the movie, and it did seem so appropriate coming off our Nordic Cinema Marathon that he said, the movie's in black and white, but it's not too serious. Uh-huh. Like, he was trying to warn everyone, don't settle in here and think you're in for something really depressing. Now, that said, like every other film almost in our Nordic Cinema Marathon, it's not a comedy.
Well,
it's also not a tragedy, but it's not a comedy. That doesn't mean there aren't real moments of levity and whimsy and kind of absurdity. And those moments do come through in a way that, again, I think we would expect after seeing a lot of films from this region.
Right. And it's not even the low chuckle that I talked about so much. It's just that there are moments of lightness here and there that are really well handled.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know why I didn't ask him about this afterward. It would be a surprise to me if it really was an influence, but the movie I couldn't help thinking about the whole time I was watching Olli Maki, and I mean this absolutely as a compliment, is Don't Look Back. Speaking of D.A. Pennebaker, the documentary filmmaker who made The War Room, one of our election poll candidates there, but that's a film that follows Bob Dylan on this tour of England. Grainy, black and white. This film is shot back in 1962 in black and white, very grainy, handheld camera. Most of the film that stalks this character who is getting overwhelmed with the expectations being put on him and the way people are already trying to herald him as a champion when he hasn't earned anything yet. And again, he's just a very kind of quiet, introverted guy. Well, Bob Dylan, of course, is too. He's doing something on a grand stage, but he's someone who doesn't want to be at these press conferences, is very elusive. And the way the camera stalks him is very much the way the camera stalks Dylan in Don't Look Back. There's a real parallel there, and I am curious if that's a film that is one that's on his radar at all as a filmmaker.
Well, this is interesting. I think this is before you had come up, but when I was talking to Kosman, and he mentioned, we were talking about Davy Moore, the American boxer that Olli Maki faced off against, and he mentioned the Dylan song, which I had forgotten about, Who Killed Davy Moore?
Huh.
So there's, I
maybe
don't know if
he is a Dylan guy.
Right, that could very well be.
Yeah, it's a very good film, and I'm not surprised that it's getting some of the attention that it is, including, I believe it's the Finnish entry for Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars. And it's not a crowd-pleasing type of film, even though it's in the genre, I suppose, broadly, of a boxing film and a sports story. It's very much not that. It is about that central relationship, I think, that is so key. And we do encourage you to see it if you have a chance. I don't think it's coming out until 2017 in theaters. But again, if you're here in Chicago and you have tickets to the fest, you can see it on Monday, the 24th. We will link to more information in our show notes at filmspotting.net. And we did want to do a little bit of a Chicago Film Fest roundup here. We have not had the opportunity to see as many films as we would like, but we have each partaken in a few. And one of the ones you've seen, and I know you feel very strongly about, is a movie that was on my Chicago Film Fest preview, I think my number two. And ironically, you're the one who has seen it, not me. But Daughters of the Dust, one of the films that they showed a restored version of, the 1991 film from Julie Dash, hugely influential film in the African-American film community, the first movie made by a black female filmmaker to get a theatrical distribution. If I'm remembering my notes from that Chicago Film Fest preview show correctly, why did this one resonate with you so much?
Well, this one really deserved a full blind spotting review, but I'll try to keep this brief. Basically, it's set around 1902, and this family reunion is taking place on an island that's off the Georgia coast. So some of the family members have lived on this island for generations. Others have since moved off and they're coming back. And sort of the tension is whether they should stay there within those traditions and keep those separate traditions or move to the north and begin a new way of living. So it's really about a people who are out of time and place. And that's how this movie feels. I've seen there are very few I can compare it to, just in the way that Dash uses vignettes and tableaus. There are stories told from the past, and then there are visions that are discussed of what the future could be. And she melds these things with the music and repeated imagery and figures like this unborn child who narrates much of the film and we see skipping around, but is, I don't know if you can call her a ghost. She's a non-existent presence yet, but has this physical presence in the film. So all of this is just really beautifully composed and moves at its own unique rhythm and is giving us a glimpse of people who I have never heard about a community like this in American history. And the fact that there are rich stories like this and places and communities that could be explored and film overall, independent or Hollywood or otherwise, has rarely done that. It's at once amazing to experience this film, and it feels so different and unique and kind of sad because it really shouldn't be. You know, we should have – other movies should have searched out these stories before that and since Daughters of the Dust came out. So just – I mean, one of the things that's such a relief is there's not a white person to be found.
Yeah.
You know, in this film, and the family proceeds that way. They are descendants of slaves, and so that's very haunting in their past, yet they're creating their own new culture and sharing that, and so it's just this little corner of black history that's rarely visited by movies in this way.
It's 50 years since slavery, Mr. Sneed, but here we still give our children names like my own and I own her, you need her, I adore her, you adore her. We even have a Pete and repeat.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. One of the films that I was able to catch up with here during the fest is the latest from Errol Morris, a favorite documentary filmmaker of mine. His new film is The B-Side, Elsa Dorfman's Portrait Photography. And unfortunately, as of right now, there are no more Chicago Film Fest screenings and no current release date set. I can recommend the movie not as heartily as I can recommend many other Errol Morris films, but this is a film about just what the title suggests. Elsa Dorfman, who is a photographer I have not been aware of, who for decades has been shooting portraits in this Polaroid format that doesn't exist anymore, 20 by 24 inch camera she's using to shoot these. Apparently there are only like six of them in existence, and they make these really large prints. And she's shot Bob Dylan over the years and many portraits of Allen Ginsberg, who she had a very long professional relationship with. And she is, like a lot of Morris subjects, an eccentric, obviously. She's a bit obsessive. She's devoted to this particular format and her work, though I would say she's not as eccentric or obsessive perhaps as many other of his subjects. But I do think, for better or for worse, the film is ultimately as quaint and approachable as Elsa herself, which I do think is mostly a good thing, but it left me wanting a little bit because there are a few hints here and there at what I think, based on other films of his that I've seen, maybe drew him into her work. And it's not just the obsession. One of them is where the title comes from, and this comes up maybe three quarters of the way through the film, the B-side. She explains at one point that when she was taking photos of families or anyone that wanted a portrait, not just famous people, they would come and there's always an A portrait and a B portrait. The A is the one they choose.
Okay.
The B is the one that they don't choose. And so we see some of those from these families over the past couple decades that they've decided don't work. And you can look at them and think, well, yeah, the eyes are kind of closed there, or the sun in that shot is looking a little goofy or away from the camera or whatever it is. And she raises the notion that maybe the B-side photos are actually the better photo, or at least they are to her, and depending on who's looking at them. So I think that's a really fascinating idea to explore that really only kind of comes up in passing. And then despite it being in the title, I felt like was mostly discarded. And there is also the idea of the reality that's being captured in the photo versus the artifice, which has been a dominant theme throughout Morris's entire career. And she says at one point, even though she's a photographer who is certainly trying to capture authenticity, she is fully aware of how much of a performance it still is with the camera, and that the camera is never really capturing the capital T truth.
Especially for family portraits.
Yeah, especially for family portraits, right? Where everyone's all dolled up and putting on their best face and their best behavior. So that, again, is brought up, but maybe not explored as much as I would have liked, and maybe as much as it would have been in previous films from Errol Morris, but still worth seeing just to be introduced to work that I didn't know existed at all and is pretty fascinating. The other film, Josh, that is more of a conundrum for me, and I recommend people seek it out ahead of the Morris film, even though I have such divided feelings about it, it is the film that came up in the comments from Zach during our poll question feedback, where he talked about really wanting to see A Quiet Passion after seeing Terrence Davies' Sunset Song and seeing Cynthia Nixon again, who he loves so much in James White. She is really, really remarkable in the Emily Dickinson biopic, A Quiet Passion, Terrence Davies' latest film. And this is another one that I think, and this is a good thing because I need more time to wrestle with it, isn't going to come out until 2017. I think she's probably going to be on the radar for a lot of Oscar talk when we get into that year, and I think it will all be well-deserved. But this is a film, and I love Sunset Song, and I liked it more than you did, as you recall, Josh.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie that either is a misfire, a beautifully shot, beautifully acted misfire, or it's a masterpiece. And I think the fact that I'm still unsure of it is why I so strongly recommend it. I think people do need to reckon with this film.
Can you pinpoint what's holding you up at least?
I can. There's a certain redundancy to the film where you're watching, it seems, scene after scene of Emily Dickinson doing something inappropriate, behaving a bit indecently. She's an iconoclast, right? She lives at home with her family. She doesn't seem to want to play by society's rules, whether it comes to ideas of faith and religion or gender, what a woman should and shouldn't do. She also just doesn't really want to leave her house, right? So she's another eccentric character. And she will have encounters with different people who come to the house. And she will, as I said, behave indecently in some way. She'll then be reproached by her family for behaving indecently, and she'll punish herself for it, and then repeat it all over again. That just seems to happen. That's the structure of this film, is her just constantly doing something wrong and then being punished for it and punishing herself for it. And then there's a redundancy as well in the dialogue and the form, too, so much so that I can't imagine it isn't wholly intentional. And this is where I want to give Davies so much credit. It's as if he is trying to capture Dickinson's poetic voice.
That's what I was thinking.
As prose.
Yeah,
right,
as you were
in
describing
the dialogue.
It.
Mm-hmm. So every conversation in this film takes the form of a riddle, it seems. It's almost mathematical, where it feels like a formula to these exchanges. At one point, a character will say something like, familiarity, as they say, breeds contempt. And the person will respond, perhaps contempt breeds familiarity. And then often someone will add a third twist on the words for everybody to ponder.
Ah, the eternal Miss Buffon. Alas, no, sir. Father Time knocks at my door also.
And what precautions do you take?
I contrive never to be at home when he calls.
All women should aspire to that state of readiness.
No. Women should only aspire to be younger than their waistlines. Then the unpleasant topic of age becomes almost irrelevant.
And what should men aspire to?
Tobogganing.
And in warmer weather?
Philately. It has all the dangers of sport without any of the rigor.
And this just keeps repeating over and over again. It's also excessively theatrical. It's almost like a parody of costume dramas where, in keeping with what I'm saying about the manner of speech, it's as if everyone is speaking in an elevated way. They know almost they're in a costume drama, so they make pronouncements. They don't talk at all like, quote-unquote, normal people do. They make pronouncements to each other. And that all said, there's so much delight in so many of these exchanges and so much wisdom that is passed on in these conversations. And Davies and his approach visually, these tableau shots, the subtle camera movements, his use of light and dark, just like in Sunset Song, seeing Dickinson in her room with just candlelight and the dark around her, and the way that camera really does move through the space of this house is wondrous. And there's one sequence, Josh, that's magical, completely magical, where we are introduced to all of the main characters at younger points in their lives, and they sit down for portraits, actually. And right before our eyes, they transform into the actors who portray them at a later stage. That's the way he elides time and brings us to the quote-unquote present day to meet these characters again. And it happens so gracefully. The effect is so stunning that it kind of takes your breath away. You aren't sure what's happening as you watch someone become someone else in front of you. And they're just those kinds of little surprises.
There's a similar moment
sprinkled throughout this film.
Isn't there with the wedding and Sunset Song?
Maybe.
that works someone's way. Yeah. I wonder if the key to this is in her poetry, and visiting that closely and putting the movie in that context maybe unlocks it a little bit. I'm looking forward to seeing that one. And I should also mention, I don't think I did this, that Daughters of the Dust, there is going to be a screening yet if Chicago area listeners are able to catch that. It's Sunday the 23rd. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening to this before then and are at all inclined to check it out, seeing it on the big screen would be great.
Yeah, and A Quiet Passion is another one of those that unfortunately doesn't have any more screenings here at the festival, and we don't have that exact release date set. I swear I read something like February 2017, but we'll just have to see and share more information when we get it on that film. But I can't wait for other people to see this movie, and there have been some reviews. I know Richard Brody in The New Yorker called it a masterpiece. I haven't read his thoughts on it yet, though, so I can't really reckon with those, but I can't wait for other people to reckon with the movie and listeners in particular and have them share their thoughts and tell me, is this a misfire for Davies or is it indeed a masterpiece? The Chicago International Film Festival closes on Thursday, the 27th of October, with a screening of Denis Villeneuve's Arrival with Amy Adams. For remaining screenings and showtimes for this year's CIFF, you can find that at chicagofilmfestival.com. And one quick aside about Arrival, don't have the details yet, haven't posted them on our website yet, but this is a film that got a lot of buzz coming out of the Toronto International Film Festival, and we are going to give away some free advanced screening passes to that movie as well in the coming week. So if you're interested in that movie, stay tuned to filmspotting.net.
Well, thanks again to MUBI for inviting us to the happiest day in the life of Oli Maki at the fest. And thanks to them for streaming Luis Buñuel's Robinson Crusoe this past month. We'll discuss Crusoe, the latest film in our Buñuel marathon, next. Stay with us.
Life is but a dream for a teenage queen.
with the off week and some other items to get to, Josh, we haven't had a donation segment in a little while, and I'm glad to have the chance here to share some thank yous and to share a few listener comments. First, we did want to highlight the music we are featuring this week. The artist is Deep Valley, and that's Deep with an A and Valley without an E, just to be extra difficult. But you got to love the name of their new album, Femagism, on Novato Music.
How do you spell that, Adam?
With a J.
Okay, thank you.
Does that give it to you? Okay,
I got it.
More information at deepvalley.com. We also got this great note. Remember the great Economowoc controversy of 2016? Who could forget? Well, Don Hertz, who I think was the listener who donated to the show that forced us to say the word Economowoc. At least I said it properly, Josh. I don't even know how you said it anymore.
I'm trying to remember.
I was too the other day, trying to see how you could get it so wrong. I mean, it's a tough word, but I don't know how you did it. We'll have to go back to the archive.
Economowoc. Was that it?
It was not that bad.
Okay.
No, it was not that bad.
You would have known that that was.
But we've heard from some listeners in Economowoc, and Don shared this, and I thought it was worth sharing with our listeners, because you never know, there may be some listening in Wisconsin.
I received a good laugh from your post-show Economowoc discussion. I am also from Economowoc, but didn't bother writing earlier with a correction, as I assumed the original poster would jump in and take care of it.
Okay, so it wasn't Don. It wasn't Don, apparently,
it was
who
one of
who
the many
this.
Other legion of
That's
listeners
right,
who
legion.
Live in Economowoc. However, Don says, hearing that there are at least 17 people in the Economowoc area listening to Film Spotting makes me think that we are missing a great opportunity to meet up for some fun film discussions and viewings. And making fun of me, I presume. As a result, I've posted an Economowoc message in the local events and meetup section of the Film Spotting forums. If you have a few free seconds on an upcoming episode, perhaps you could mention it there. I moved here 3 years ago, and it would be great to find some local film enthusiasts. One other note, Economowoc is well known for hosting the world premiere of The Wizard of Oz on August 12, 1939 at the Strand Theater, 3 days before its Hollywood premiere. Admission was 25 cents for adults and 10 cents for kids. Those were the days.
Indeed they were. And
did
yes,
you notice?
We know that because everybody from Economowoc who wrote in pointed out their claim to fame, their cinematic claim to
common
fame.
Common knowledge in Economowoc. Do you notice how many times Don put Economowoc?
Oh, yeah.
In his
he just wanted to hear us say it.
Yeah, and knowing I'd probably screw at least one of them up. It was a trap.
I think you got it.
I passed Don.
Okay. Let's get to some donors here. Jesse in Rumford, Rhode Island. Jesse is the listener who's come up a few times over the past 6 months to a year because he is going through the Film Spotting archive, as many listeners do, in chronological order. Like, if I'm remembering the feedback correctly, he hasn't really listened to shows with you because he's actually going through them in...
At all. He just started
I think so.
What's
he went
the first
back to number
available?
One
isn't available, right?
It is on our website.
Is that where you can get it?
Yeah,
okay.
So you can go back and hear all of them. And Jesse just wrote in. He said, I finished episode 366 today, the final Maddie Ballgame episode, onto the relatively current crop of episodes. Payday is Friday. Another donation is forthcoming, and we got it. Thank you, Jesse.
All right, Jesse. Strap in. It's about to get rough for you.
Two new Silver Club donors, David in Adelaide, Australia. Now, it came through as Adelaide SA, and I meant to Google it, and I didn't. Maybe you could quickly do that, Josh, while I read another name.
I think that means San Antonio, Australia.
San Antonio. Okay. Done. No need to look it up. Mary in Iowa City, Iowa, and a new $5 a month donor, Jim Mancall. Mancall? In Cambridge, Mass.
Just signed up for a monthly donation as my way of saying thanks for all your good work. I enjoy the show every week, and you inspire me to get out there and watch new films and return to older films that I may have missed.
How about this for a cinematic town connection? Timothy, also a new $5 a month subscriber in Sierra Madre, California.
The movie of choice at my dad's church movie club this past Sunday?
Really?
Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
I noticed that your dad watched it. I saw on Letterboxd, but he didn't share any of his thoughts. So
I think, no, he doesn't usually. He just logs what he watches. Mm. But I think it was a record turnout for that.
Really? That
small
film?
Club.
Okay. Gold level donor, Jordan in Edmonton, Alberta. And finally, a new $10 a month donor, Brent Luthold in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
I've been a listener for years now, so please accept this monthly donation as a back payment of sorts for the episodes I've enjoyed in the past and the many more that I plan to enjoy in the future. Your passionate, thought-provoking, and entertaining take on the movies makes Film Spotting my most anticipated podcast every week. I just published the 100th review, a positive take on The Magnificent Seven, if you can believe it, for my film blog, Awake in the Dark, today, after exactly 2 years of writing. And thanks to your efforts, I'm now planning on starting a film discussion podcast of my own. Keep up the good work, and thank you for all that you do for cinephiles everywhere.
Well, thank you, Brent, and good luck with the podcast and the site. We will link to it, and that review. We'll link to your thoughts on The Magnificent Seven in our show notes at filmspotting.net. Josh may also be able to post it under Why I'm Wrong on his website.
I do need a new entry there.
There you go.
Good idea.
Though we were both wrong then about that film. I liked it more than you, certainly, but it sounds like not as much as Brent. I can't tell, actually, if the part where he says, if you can believe it, it's the positive take on The Magnificent Seven or that he's written 100 reviews.
Well, I was going to say, what's the threshold for when someone who started a movie blog or a podcast, as Brent's about to do, when they're in, you know, like when they're committed, they know what it takes and they're going to keep doing it. I feel like 2 years, he's done it.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
A year is a cycle, and then you start up again. You're like, you know what? This is work. Congratulations, Brent.
Yeah, there's no going back now. You're stuck.
Being the third son of a good family and not educated to any trade, my head began to be filled early with thoughts of leaving England to see the world. And thus, against the will, nay, the commands of my father, I broke loose and went to sea. How true my father's prophecy of disaster. For not long after, being in the latitude of 12 degrees 18 minutes, bound for Africa to buy Negro slaves for my fellow planters in the Brazils, a violent tornado came upon us, which carried us westward, far out of the way of all human commerce.
The opening narration there to Luis Buñuel's Robinson Crusoe from 1954. And maybe if you're familiar with Buñuel's work, you're wondering, why is it that I'm hearing any dialogue, any voiceover in English? This is a bit of an anomaly for Buñuel. It's the third film we've discussed so far in our Luis Buñuel marathon, the second feature and the second discussion. We open with the short Un Chien Andalou from 1929, followed that with L'Âge d'Or from 1930. You can find our discussions of those films over at filmspotting.net on the marathons page. But Josh, we're jumping ahead 24 years to Crusoe. We've gone out of Buñuel's early French period, past his early Spanish period, past his time in Hollywood during World War II, to his Mexican period, and pretty late in his Mexican period, a film that is in English, a film that was, I believe, financed by an American studio and did somehow manage to produce a Best Actor Oscar nomination for Dan O'Herlihy in the lead role as Robinson Crusoe in 55.
That's kind of hard to imagine,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
Not that it's a terrible performance.
No, not at all.
It's just not the type that normally would get cited.
This is a weird movie. I guess we can say that before we even get into anything. Yeah. It's a weird film, and it's a weird film for an Oscar nomination of any kind.
In how it plays out. Like, in description, it sort of fits the bill, right?
Yeah.
In that it's a literary adaptation of a literary classic. It has this prestige sound to it. But you're right. It's absolutely weird because it's – for Buñuel, it's not really that weird.
Okay, well, that's where I want to go.
But for a prestige production, it's kind of weird.
This is a film that I didn't even know Buñuel had made until this marathon, and we put together the lineup. It seems to have been largely forgotten from his filmography, and I suppose that's why I'm glad we actually did take the time here to see it and to talk about it. But if you look at Rotten Tomatoes, for example, there are only 10 reviews of it. Now, all 10 of them are positive, so it has a 100% tomato meter rating.
Which I didn't ruin.
9 of those reviews are by people not named Josh Larson. Yes, you are one of the 10 who gave it a positive rating. First, tell me how this pretty straightforward, despite its weirdness, Technicolor, American finance, English language adventure story based on Daniel Defoe's 1719 novel could be a Luis Buñuel film. Then tell me why you think it's good.
So it very gently spoofs some of the things that L'Âge d'Or very directly and not cruelly, what's the word, aggressively spoofs, I guess. Whereas this is, it's clear what it's doing, but it spoofs things like religion, Christianity, and it spoofs the bourgeois lifestyle.
Yeah.
And
oh, for sure.
Maybe that is the more humorous element where this Crusoe, played by O'Herlihy, he immediately sets about to recreate what was his aristocratic lifestyle, and he's a buffoon. He can't do it. One of his early jokes is that he can't even light a fire because the servants used to do it for me. Now,
oh, I could relate to that. Not the servants part, but the thought of being trapped on an island, not being able to even light a fire. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm by just pulling out that quote, I may be making it sound more direct, but this is interwoven with this Tony voiceover dialogue. So if you watch this, you know, not paying that close of attention, it almost would pass for a straight-faced literary adaptation.
Right.
But you notice these things that Buñuel is playing up. And when Friday comes on the scene, played by a Mexican actor, Jaime Fernandez, you get this as well, where their relationship is – it's very tricky and in some ways problematic, because if you want to lend – if you want to buy in and say Buñuel is spoofing everything, then Fernandez and the costuming and what mm-hmm. appears to be blackface – and this is 1954.
It does appear that way.
Are all part of the joke. But if you're a little reserved about, okay, where is Buñuel spoofing things and where is he not, then there's some really difficult things to watch in terms of their relationship. And I couldn't quite find the line there. But mm-hmm. just to go back a little bit and talk about some of the ways that religion is spoofed, there's a moment where Crusoe goes to this valley. I think he calls it the Valley of the Echoes. And in a moment of despair, I think it is, he shouts Psalm 23 and – hears nothing back but his own voice. I mean,
right.
that's pure Buñuel,
sure.
right? The silence of God depicted in that sort of comic way. And also this moment where
– not that he loses his faith necessarily.
No, no. And I think
– unlike some other Buñuel characters.
Right. But maybe that's part – in Buñuel's worldview,
yeah.
maybe that's part of the buffoonery.
Maybe it is.
There's the moment later on where he's reading the Bible to Friday, and Friday just – you know, he sums up the problem of evil.
Yeah,
he just looks at him and says,
favorite bit in the movie.
If God is most strong, why he not kill devil?
Well, yeah.
And that I'm that's verbatim.
Yeah.
So that gives you some idea of how Friday is portrayed here too. So
yeah.
again, these are small moments in what has a lot of standard survivor moments
mm-hmm.
and it's not as clear that this is a Buñuel film as maybe I'm making it sound by plucking those moments out. Is that fair, would you say?
Yeah, it is, though I think what I want to talk about is how much it ultimately ends up being a Buñuel film, much to my surprise. And I think that really is, unfortunately, maybe the only real pleasures of this film for me are watching it within this more academic exercise.
I'd agree.
Of seeing all these Buñuel films. Maybe if you're a completist, especially when it comes to auteurs, then I could see why you would devote the time to this film. But I start watching it, even before it starts, I just know it's an adaptation of Robinson Crusoe, and I'm thinking, how is this going to be a Buñuel film? For me, based on the few that I've seen, and I think the count is maybe at six or so, these movies are going to have to in some way deal with religion. You've touched on it, whether characters discuss religion a lot or religion's a backdrop, or you do have characters who are ostensibly pious and maintain it and maybe are the object of some derision, or characters who endure a crisis of faith. There's going to be a satirical element to it. You're going to send up the bourgeois, middle and upper class, whoever is in power in society, in politics, in the church, and he's just generally pretty cynical about human nature. So he's going to have objects to throw some scorn at. And then these movies are going to be about sex, if not actual sex. If we don't actually see it depicted, the act of it, then they're going to be about sexual repression or characters who are preoccupied with it in some way.
And there's at least one moment that directly plays to that.
Right. So for a while, I'm thinking, for a good chunk of this movie, how is this movie going to fit within that scheme at all? And then you get to the fact that Crusoe does discover the Bible. And he's very accepting of God. And you pointed out some of the scenes where he is openly reading from the Bible or looking for God's answer. And I think we can say he undergoes an existential crisis, though it's not so much a crisis of faith as it is just the crisis of being alone.
Loneliness.
For
yeah.
2 decades on an island. And he does undergo a little bit of an actual mental breakdown. Now, along the line of religion, there's a pretty funny joke in here that Buñuel gets in where he has a cat and a dog with him. And at one point, the cat has kittens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Buñuel's version of the Immaculate Conception. And the voiceover even says...
Yeah, he says, "How I, that's one
I,
mystery,
one
I,
mystery.
Never,
yeah.
I never solve it on all
right.
my time in the island."
There you go. Now, the cynicism and the satire, it occurred to me anyway that when he does finally develop a relationship with another human being, Friday, it's been over 20 years, I think, at this point, that he's been alone. He immediately subjugates him.
Yes.
Now, he was setting out on a journey initially to purchase slaves. So this isn't exactly shocking, but you would just think that maybe after enduring 2 decades alone on an island, no companionship whatsoever, when you finally get it, it's pretty hilarious in a way, or it says something about human nature, that he immediately falls back into the master type of role and wants to bend this man to his will. So I think that's Boonwell getting in some commentary there. And there is that challenge to his faith. I thought where you were going to go with that exchange with him in Friday, where he says, if God's all powerful, then why not kill devil? That is rudimentary. And while there's some actual provocative theological thinking behind it, it's maybe not expressed that eloquently. That scene culminates with a real theological challenge, though. He says, in so many words, if God allows the devil and sin to exist, then why does God get angry with us when we sin?
Yeah, no, it's
a great question, right? A legitimately great question. But
tied to the problem of evil and
yeah,
all
and here's
that,
the
yeah.
buffoonery, though. The commentary is, instead of taking the provocation, he just laughs it off.
Right.
Crusoe laughs it off and actually says to his parrot or some bird there that you understand the Bible better than Friday does. He immediately tries to dismiss it. So we're 2 for 2 so far with this film. And then it's a stretch maybe, but we're 3 for 3 in terms of the sex. It's very sneaky. But there is a moment in the film where he puts a dress on to mm-hmm. create a scarecrow. And I don't know if it's the same dress or not. I didn't go back to look. But there's a deliciously awkward moment when Friday at one point comes out wearing a gold necklace and he's wearing that dress. And he's all excited to come out and present himself to Crusoe wearing this dress. And there's that pause. And then he finally says, take that off.
Oh, yeah.
Angrily. Yeah. And it reads to me, and maybe this is just because I'm reading Boonwell into it, it reads to me as if he's saying, not just stop being foolish, but maybe you should take that dress off before I do something foolish.
Oh,
I've been alone for over 20 years. That's what
sense.
I read into it.
Yeah, you definitely get the sense the scene could go in that direction. In a way, this is O'Herlihy's performance versus Boonwell's sensibility.
Yeah.
And if you want to give them the most credit, you say that they coordinated on this and planned it all along and it works perfectly. But you definitely see O'Herlihy committed to this heroic version of Crusoe recreating his society, mm-hmm. maintaining his traditions in the midst of nothing, that he's been dropped here and look what he's managed to mm-hmm. erect out of his own greatness. And then you have Boonwell constantly eating away at, well, is this really so great?
Yeah.
And the confusion of the movie is that it ends with Crusoe as the champion.
I was going to say.
You watch the beginning of this, the first 5 minutes and the last 5 minutes,
yeah.
and you think you're watching, it was called Family Classics when I was a kid on WGN.
Yeah, it
every
opens
afternoon,
with the book opening and closing.
They show the cover of the book and you hear the voiceover and you would not know the difference. So it's just very probably part of Boonwell's joke as well that I'm going to end this.
Yeah.
Exalting Crusoe to the position he wanted all along.
Yeah. No.
While I've undermined it for whatever, 80 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say that it's maybe the least Boonwellian aspect of the film that it's so hopeful at the end. We finally have Crusoe get over his paranoia, his distrust of Friday. Really, that master-servant relationship is finally turned on its head a little bit and they're more equal. And then he does work together with some noble men to return home. It's this really happy, heroic mm-hmm. kind of ending, which does seem at odds with most of what we know of Boonwell and his view of people. I think one of my struggles with this film, or among the struggles I had with this film, was the fact that it's encumbered by that narration and the fact that he's alone, right, on this island.
It's so the narration
tells us everything.
Yes.
It lacks any of the ambiguity that makes Boonwell's films so interesting. And think about where we've come from those first two movies, L'Âge d'Or and Un Chien d'Andalou, where we were, as individual viewers, constructing meaning moment to moment, scene
right.
to scene.
Sort of desperately.
Out of whole cloth, yeah. right? And here, nothing ever is really in question. There is nothing ambiguous to chew on. And I think as well, just from a visual standpoint, it feels very oddly like a National Geographic documentary at times, where he's just capturing life. And a lot of times it's very clear that the sound wasn't shot live, or they're not using that live sound. So you get these really awkward Foley moments of his footsteps or doing something with the rocks. You can tell that most of the sound was added in post, and there's a real disconnect that's present throughout between what we see and what we hear, and also this narrative that we're watching that, like I said, feels sometimes like Buñuel just wants to shoot, almost like he did in Land Without Bread, a documentary of his that I have seen and really enjoy, almost like he just wants to shoot the creature moving along the sand. It's at odds with each other in a way that, I don't know, wasn't as satisfying, I suppose, as I hoped this movie would be.
I will say, for the narration, I too found it just, you know, too much. I wish it had stopped, but I think it is operating at odds with what we're watching. So it's Crusoe building himself up, making grand claims about himself, mm-hmm. while we're seeing the exact opposite in the action. So it's maybe not redundant as much as it is just repetitive,
yeah.
in that it continues throughout the whole film. So I agree with that. There are, and you're also right about many of the visuals, although I did like the one really nice poetic touch when he's at a moment of crisis. He's holding the torch, wades into the water, and it's a long shot. So mm-hmm. it's one of the beautiful compositions that takes advantage of the landscape. And I believe it's either sunrise or sunset. And he just sort of lets his arms fall mm-hmm. and the torch hits the water and goes out. And there's some delicacy there that I like that maybe most of the rest of the film doesn't have.
Yeah. Robinson Crusoe, no longer available on Mubi. We hope many of our listeners did sign up for the free trial or are users of Mubi. They are the presenting sponsor of this Buñuel marathon. But if you didn't, you can still see Robinson Crusoe. It's available in a few different formats, and I think from a few different services, including Netflix. But as we said, very pleased to have Mubi on board as the presenting sponsor of this marathon. In addition to Crusoe and Death in the Garden, the next film we're going to talk about, they also have right now a special going on. Their New York Film Festival projections, they're highlighting groundbreaking films from the New York Film Festival, a program that highlights the work of filmmakers, challenging what the moving image can do and be. Mubi started with a series of films from projections of years past, and this week they're introducing their favorites fresh from the 2016 program, which ran earlier this month, October 7th through the 9th. They're all showing exclusively on Mubi. And Josh, if that's not enough, they've got two really great double features now showing. Perfect as we get into next week and our Halloween show. As part of their Halloween series, they've got a Ty West double bill, including the movie that really brought him to a lot of viewers' attention, The House of the Devil, followed by The Innkeepers. Hal Hartley, also a double bill going on with his work, Meanwhile, and The Book of Life. So a lot of great stuff, as always, to check out via Mubi. You can sign up for a free trial for 30 days by going to Mubi.com/filmspotting. That's Mubi.com/filmspotting. Robinson Crusoe, as we said, the second feature, the second entry in our marathon, the third one, The Death in the Garden, will come up in a few weeks. If you want to participate in this marathon, and we hope you will, it always makes it more fun when we get your feedback. You can find the full lineup of Buñuel films at filmspotting.net. Just click on Marathons.
I think that's a show, right?
I think it is.
All right. Let us know what you thought. Send your comments to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can leave us a voicemail as well if you'd rather. The number for that is 312-264-0744. If you missed that, just look for it under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. You can, of course, find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Adam is at filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. Also at filmspotting.net, we've got 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. You can also vote for the current Film Spotting poll there. We're asking for your favorite election movie. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both of those in iTunes or on your podcast app, and you'll be able to find both of those along with us live coming up November 18 and 19 as part of the Chicago Podcast Film Festival.
Again, ticket information at chicagopodcastfestival.org. And a quick programming note, Film Spotting SVU this week has a review of the Amazon series Fleabag, and Matt and Allison share their picks for other streaming movies that break the fourth wall. Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, the art house in your house. Learn more at rentmoviesondemand.com. And I can't listen to the latest episode of The Next Picture Show that just came out because I haven't had time to watch Westworld on HBO. I'm really intrigued by it. It seems right up my alley. And they did devote their current set of episodes to the Westworld series and the original Westworld movie from the 70s. So if you're into that series and want to hear those great hosts and critics, Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, Genevieve Kosky, talk about Westworld, you can do that just by searching in iTunes for The Next Picture Show.
I'm in that boat with their Don't Breathe episode because I still need to see Don't Breathe, so I can't listen until I get
I love
that.
That one because I've seen Don't Breathe, talked about it on the show, and recommended it, and Wait Until Dark.
Right, Hepburn movie.
Yeah, the Katharine Hepburn movie, a perfect, brilliant pairing, yep. A movie that was actually discussed on Film Spotting After Hours many years ago. It was a listener's choice recommendation. So yeah, that's another good one. They're doing some great stuff.
I think
there.
It's Film Spotting After Hours about now, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. We need to wind this up, Josh. Out in wide release this weekend, Boo! A Madea Halloween. I don't know why we're not devoting next week's show to Boo. Jack Reacher 2. Genevieve had a great tweet today saying anytime you refer to the movie Jack Reacher, you should refer to it as Jack Reacher. Like one word.
I like that.
Jack
that
Reacher.
Sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's somehow way more fun. Ouija? What is that word, Josh?
Well, when I used to play it with my family as a kid, we said Ouija.
Ouija. Origin of Evil and Keeping Up with the Joneses. Normal seeming neighbors, actually government spies. Gal Gadot, Isla Fisher, John Hamm, Zach Galifianakis.
Okay, gun to your head.
Yeah.
You have to see one of these.
I love this game.
Boo, A Madea Halloween, or Ouija 2, Origin of Evil. Where is Adam Kempinar going?
I thought you might throw in Keeping Up with the Joneses. Ouija 2 sounds like it will scare me more, but I'm going with that ahead of Boo. What about you?
I can guarantee Boo would scare you more.
Out in limited release, American Pastoral, Ewan McGregor's adaptation of the Philip Roth novel, Camera Person, my most anticipated movie of the fall. I'm halfway through it, Josh. The documentary from cinematographer Kirsten Johnson. Certain Women, you heard my interview with Kelly Reichardt and heard our thoughts on it earlier in the show. We highly recommend that. And In the Valley of Violence, the latest from Ty West, starring Ethan Hawke and John Travolta. So a lot out now that you can see or choose not to see if you so desire. Next weekend, we will get into a Halloween special. We're still finalizing the content. Whatever we do, it will be a lot of fun, including that top five we are planning to get to where we're going to share the scenes from movies from our childhood that terrified us. Josh, I'm going to make sure all the lights are on in the studio. You are not allowed
to. It's getting hard here. Yeah. Every time we come, it's a little darker for some reason.
I don't know why that is.
I think after 3 a.m. they try to save money on the light bills.
Maybe that's it. We're just here too late.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week is by Deep Valley. It comes from the album Femagism. More information is at DEAPVALLY.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening. I'm just disappointed you didn't say Femagism again.
Wiener.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
We haven't had time for our warm-ups, and we haven't actually seen each other in like a week and a half because of
a week off.
So have you been watching anything?
Yes, but I don't want to talk about it because I feel like I'll trample on your childhood. This seems like one of those movies that you...
You finally watch Eddie and the Cruisers.
Well, we're in that territory. We are in that territory, and it feels like one you would really still hold close to your heart.
Do you know if I do or not?
I don't.
Oh, okay.
And if you brought it up on the show before, I apologize, because it wouldn't have stuck with me because I never saw it until last Friday night. Family movie night, Footloose.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
I've seen it 100 times.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And when's the last time you saw it?
I have not seen the original Footloose in its entirety since I was probably 11.
Okay.
I've seen scenes here or there. Now, I watched the Craig Brewer Footloose because
I
reviewed it.
I do remember that.
And I thought
you saw that one.
I thought it was terrible. And I certainly think compared to that, the original Footloose is great. But I think Footloose is one of those movies for me that exists in that nostalgic wheelhouse where
you don't want to watch it again. Then.
Well, no, I would watch it again. I just don't. I don't see how it could
be bad.
Bother me. I don't see how it could be bad.
Would it bother you if there was barely any good dancing in a movie that's about dancing?
Oh,
because that kind of bothered me.
I disagree.
Bacon is brutal.
It's
like
Kevin Bacon is a god in that film.
Do you remember that he's like a gymnast slash dancer?
Yeah.
So he's doing like acro dancing.
You're gonna knock that amazing let off steam scene.
Oh, man.
In the barn.
It's not just that it's cheesy. Like I feel
it is cheesy
compared to musicals that I appreciate.
But this isn't a musical.
No, but it has production numbers. I know it's not a musical. That's true. They don't sing. But it has dedicated production numbers in which the dancing is terrible. And that's a problem. This is I just wrote about it finally today. He's like a machete chopping through a jungle. It's hard chops. It's like every movement he makes is like severe. It comes to an end, and there's an awkward pause, and then he makes his next severe move.
It's
there's
jagged.
No elegant. It jagged
no,
is the word.
No, it's not. You're right. It's not elegant, but I guess certainly at the time when I saw it, I had nothing to compare it to. I wouldn't have seen. Yeah.
I don't know how I missed it. Honestly, I don't know how I missed. Although there's I guess a couple of
but
these that I have missed.
There's still a rawness, and there's still, if not an elegance, there's still something athletic that is still exciting to watch.
When he flies through the air like a squirrel, and they cut to it three times in a row. That's
cheesy.
Incredible filmmaking.
See, this is the problem with watching 80s films for the first time in 2016 as a bitter, cynical film critic.
Do you remember the game of chicken with tractors?
Of course I do. I remember every scene of that film and can probably recite it for you.
Best answer, Chris Penn.
Now,
clearly, no, I'm being serious. Like he,
okay, but he has no sense of rhythm, Josh. So that tells me a lot about your sense of rhythm.
No, he has something, and that's part of the character, right? That is like he doesn't know what he's doing, so he's playing
he
into
has
that.
Two left feet.
But at least by the end, there's like a sort of a joy to what he's doing.
Okay,
that Bacon is just like
no,
man,
but
he's karate chopping all over the place.
But if you think about it, though, you are right that. To compare it to some of these other dance movies just isn't really fair because there's not any dancing in it. You're right. There isn't. Like, until the end, Kevin Bacon doesn't really get a good dance scene.
They have the end scene.
I still think that's pretty great.
They have an end scene. They have the angry factory dance.
Yeah.
And then they have the early one at the diner where she turns on the radio and suddenly everyone's
– He's not in that, though.
No, he's not in that one. But and that one's okay. Mm-hmm. That one's
oh, they
like,
have the one
you know,
at the bar when they drive into the town
next
door.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where Chris Penn gets into the fight.
Yeah.
So we watched this. Why did I watch Footloose now?
Yeah.
Because they
plus Ariel's a tramp. You let your kids watch that?
Well, PG.
Uh-huh.
Before there was PG-13, we realized fairly quickly into it. So, they were very mixed about her character. I think they found her interesting in the fact that she's not just like standing by. She's driving a lot of the story and the action. But I think there's also
she's her own person.
She is her own person.
Yeah.
But anyways, we watched it with them because it's the choice for Adeline's school's musical in the spring.
No kidding.
They announced it. And
I'd love to see how that's different.
Yeah.
How it's been altered for high school.
I know. It's gonna be interesting.
Mean, not so much that I want to go, mind you, but
well. Excuse me, sir.
I hadn't gotten the invitation anyway, so.
And you will not be getting one.
I guess not. So what is Addie going to be up for? Is she going to try out for it?
Oh, yeah. She loves
she
musicals.
Does.
Yeah. She's fairy number one in Midsummer
Night's
Dream. I
heard that. We went to In the Heights here in Chicago.
Yeah, you know
I took my daughter. You took your oldest daughter.
We have two musical theater fans, so.
Yeah, well. Yeah, Sophie, her favorite movie in the world of all time, of course, is Singing in the Rain. So she is obsessed with that. She thinks...
Don't let her see Footloose.
She thinks Lin-Manuel Miranda is our Lord and Savior. So she's... I don't know that she's a Broadway fan or a musical theater fan so much as she's a Lin-Manuel Miranda fan at this point. But she did really like In the Heights. Addie seemed to as well.
They both liked it.
It was a good production here in Chicago.
It was so fun. A relatively small theater in the round. And, speaking of the dancing, it was amazing and on such a small space and so many people moving around at once. And yeah, really enjoyable, especially as sort of an indicator of how the music would develop just a little bit into what is Hamilton.
We all talked about that, of course, in the car going home. And Addie was familiar with In the Heights. You hadn't listened to it at all, right?
No, I had not.
Yeah, and neither of us had, me or Sophie. And there are certain elements where you recognize, I mean, thematically, there's a lot of crossover. And musically, there are moments where you hear Nina sing certain lines and it sounds just like Eliza. And so you can tell it's the same guy, without a doubt. Yeah. But at the same time, of course, Hamilton is just, in terms of ambition.
Scope, sure.
And scope is much grander. But it's still pretty great. And I see why everyone went as crazy for In the Heights as they did. And of course, we'll have to see how everything goes next week on the show. But I've got Hamilton this weekend.
That's Sophie, right.
Sophie has been... She's been counting down literally the minutes
I hope it can live up to. I'm sure it will.
I think it will. I don't see how it couldn't.
Yeah.
Especially this cast is supposed to be pretty remarkable. So the other thing we're watching at home right now is that new Kiefer Sutherland show, Designated Survivor.
Oh,
have
yeah.
you seen the previews
yeah,
for it? Though I shouldn't say we're watching because I've been left out as the single tear comes down. Because we were hearing about the show coming up. I had seen the previews a million times. And Holden was in the car one day telling us something about the cabinet. And so I was have you? Because he's obsessed with that stuff.
Yeah,
and
he would like that.
Yeah, I said, have you heard of this show? Of course he hadn't because he doesn't watch TV. He's always on the internet. And I told him the premise of the show. And he's like, yeah, I'd like to see that. So we DVR'd it. A couple days after the premiere, we sat down, me, Holden, and Sarah, and we watched it. And I mean, of course, it's a compelling premise, this notion that the guy who's like the HUD secretary,
right,
and he's actually about to get fired, so they leave him as the guy who doesn't get to go to the speech.
And this is accurate. Has Holden confirmed this is accurate?
It is true.
Okay.
Apparently that there truly is a designated survivor.
Okay.
So there's a bombing. Everything goes terribly, and he's the last man standing, and so he's the new president. So Holden was pretty into it, and we enjoyed it. And then we just have been so busy, and I've been home so infrequently.
Who's watching it behind whose back?
Well, yeah, that's what happened. Two episodes piled up, episodes 2 and 3, and then episode 4, I think, was just this past Wednesday, and I was on the road or something, and I came home, and I was like, man, we've got a lot of episodes to catch up on.
Well, you do.
Yeah, and Sarah's like, oh, me and Holden sat down on Saturday or Sunday and watched 2 and 3.
Ouch.
And there's nothing I can do about
that kinda,
it.
That hurts.
It does hurt. It does, because I wanted something that Holden and I could do together. But when your old man's never around, what do I expect him to do?
That's kind of your fault. Is he a rewatcher? Would he watch him again with you?
He probably would.
That'll be a test of his love.
We'll see.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.